Last time we met, we took note of how the leaders of Judea tried to ensure the continuation of their autonomy and especially their religious uniqueness as they anticipated the change in rulership from being part of the Ptolemaic Empire to coming under the rule of the Seleucids. And we saw that after a false start, which eliminated their contractual status as temple land, which they enjoyed under the Ptolemies, that when the real Seleucid invasion came, that Judea was able to render significant assistance to Antiochus the Great and consequently was rewarded with a grant which enabled them to continue their internal self-government and their cultural and religious autonomy. That, however, rather than having these privileges guaranteed upon the rock, you might say, foundation of their classification of temple land as they had had it for most of the period under the Ptolemies, this grant of autonomy rested upon the sandy foundation of the goodwill of this particular ruler. And that it didn't take too long for a number of people to become concerned about the fact that their guarantees rested on such a shaky foundation. Now, in order for us to understand what they began to do about that, we need to look back again to the 100-year period from approximately 301 to 200 BC. This is the period when they were under the rule of the Ptolemies. Now, granted that there were no clerics established in Judea, no military colonies of, you might say, reserve soldiers that acted as nuclei for the spread of Hellenistic civilization. Granted, there was no expropriation of land to provide land for these clerics. There was also no expropriation of land to pay the salaries of Ptolemaic officials, since they were not introduced in Judea due to its temple land status. And they were spared, of course, the necessity of having, therefore, to be rubbing cheek by jowl with lots of Hellenistic civilization. We have to recognize that manners of living and manners of thinking are different than, let's say, physical armies. And that is, you can construct barriers against physical armies and hope to keep them out, but you can't erect barriers around a country, insulating them from the ways of living and ways of thinking of surrounding peoples. You cannot construct such barriers. The Soviet Union in our age has tried very hard and has not succeeded. If one travels in the Soviet Union, so I'm told, since I have not done so, and I probably will not do so unless specifically commanded by the work. No. I have no objection to going there. I have a great desire to, but I will not do so unless commanded by the work as long as my mother lives. But that's another story, and I won't go into why, unless she prematurely... I don't want to get to that. Anyway, so I'm told that Western music, Western clothing fads, and so on are very common among the youth in the Soviet Union, although they live in maybe one of the most closed societies in the world. Why is it that it is impossible to hermetically seal off a people from influences, cultural influences from the surrounding areas? Well, primarily because some people do travel into the area that bring those influences. And also, even in a fairly closed society, which Judea was not, you know, which the Soviet Union is, people do travel outside. They do see these things. They do bring back some examples of the things they see. And this was the case of Judea. The upper class folk of Judea having the leisure, the money, and perhaps the need to travel to Hellenistic centers, did so. While the average small farmer or tenant farmer in Judea, having no need to travel abroad and lacking the leisure and the money to afford to do so, did not. And so because basically of social status, you began to develop in this period, though it develops slowly, but it does develop, and it's sort of like a slowly rising curve. It increases in its slope as it goes on, as it progresses. You do develop a distinction between the upper class and the common herd in terms of their cultural leanings, let us say. So we have the upper class secular people. We also have even the priests with high administrative positions. As opposed to the common herd, which is the bulk of the population, which is mainly farmers, artisans, etc., that these people are the stay-at-homes and how many of you come from farming areas? Okay, I know this has changed in the last 20 years, but still, I think that you would acknowledge that the areas you come from are in many ways more conservative than many city areas. And so you have a sort of a natural conservatism also among these people, too. So we can call them naturally conservative. These people, because of their, as I say, either necessity, the fact they had leisure, and the fact that they had money, as a result of these factors, traveled to nearby Hellenistic centers. And what would you have expected as a result? What do you think their reaction would have been as they entered these Hellenistic centers and spent time there and so forth? Yes. Yeah, well, unfortunately, they wouldn't have gone down in Judea, and so it's sort of like the situation that I'm told, I was just reading about in yesterday's paper, occasionally happens, or more than occasionally happens, on Iranian airliners as they fly towards Europe, that after they've passed about the halfway point, all the female passengers dressed in their long, what do you call them, chadors, you know, the concealing black thing that covers everything except their eyes, down to their toes, they disappear into the restrooms and they come back in chic dresses with their nails painted and makeup on, you know, they're totally transformed because they're now going to Europe. They don't have to live as they did in Iran. They wouldn't dare live like that in Iran. They'd probably be killed in most cases. And if not that, they certainly would be very badly mistreated. So it would have been difficult for these people to incorporate in a very public way, but perhaps in the privacy of their own home, they may have been doing some things that they had picked up in the Greek world. Certainly, they were no end fascinated by it. Because, you know, what's the old expression? How are you going to keep them down on the farm once they've seen, you know, Paris? I think that's the way that usually the expression went. Or you can translate it even into American terms by saying, once they've seen the lights of the big city, how are they going to be satisfied back home? That there was a great deal of the glitter, excitement, intellectual, quote-unquote, stimulation of the sophisticated lifestyle, the Hellenistic centers. And naturally, as these wealthy people travel either on official business or on private business or simply for pleasure, they would tend to have some opportunity to mix with the upper strata in these Hellenistic centers. They would see how they lived. And they began to be attracted to it. So they certainly were fascinated by it and reasonably attracted to it. Fascinated by and attracted to many aspects of Hellenistic life. They certainly could admire the architecture, since the traditional Greek or Hellenistic architecture is very pleasing to the eye. Certainly their fashions were very attractive as far as dress. Their culinary habits were very sophisticated. The food that they would put on their table was more elaborate and more sophisticated. Everything was just very appealing. If they had attended a dramatic performance, even if they had not understood the dialogue, they still would have been impressed with the way it was done. They would have found a lot of this very interesting and attractive. Naturally, this would not have affected these people here. And we need to keep this in mind as far as the background of what was going on, even during the Ptolemaic period, to understand how different groups approached the problem after 200 BC, between the period of 200 BC and, let's say, 175 BC. Well, maybe I should use a different date. Probably should use significantly 171, which is going to become a very significant date. That during this period, this approximate 30-year period, is when the leaders of Judea began to grapple with the problem of how they are going to, let's say, shore up, strengthen their autonomy. Because after all, it rests only on the pleasure of the king at this particular point in time, and a later ruler might not feel even bound to honor that. And this king even might decide for some reason to take a dislike to Judea and cancel the autonomy. Now, last time I gave you via a little bit of artwork and some text, a description of how Antiochus the Great administered his empire. And we saw that Judea did not really fit comfortably in any of the categories that existed, you know, in terms of administration. It was not a vassal kingdom because Judea was not ruled by a king of a royal dynasty. Also because the high priest had to be appointed according to certain hereditary laws given in the Jewish law. The king couldn't just pick any of the relatives of the previous leader as his choice to be the next king or ruler. And the bulk of the population, of course, did not live in Judea. The bulk of the Jews did not live in Judea. So it didn't really fit the pattern of the vassal kingdoms. Although there was, you know, superficially it did, as was pointed out by one student. It superficially did seem to fit that. It also did not classically fit the pattern of the peoples. Because although its population was widely dispersed, there was a fairly large number that were concentrated in one area that had a sort of independent national existence, you see, which was not true of the other peoples. They didn't have any organized state of their own. If you want to find an analogy today, you'd have to say that, let's say, the Armenian community is spread around the world. They represent, well, that's not good either, because the Soviets maintain a Soviet Armenia, so that's not good. Let me find a different group. Kurds. The Kurds are an interesting ethnic group, but there is no country called Kurdistan, though some of them would like to see such. And they are spread in parts of Iran, parts of Iraq, which presents numerous difficulties, especially right now. And some of them are even in the Soviet Union. But they have no independent nation, and some of them indeed are spread around the world in other places. So that would have been typical of the other peoples. They're spread around all over the empire, but they have no organized national state within the empire. Well, Jews did. They at least had Judea as an organized state. But the ethnarch pattern, which is a solely appointive office under the Seleucid ruler in that classification, doesn't fit because the high priest is functioning as the ruler of Judea, and it's an inherited office, again, according to the rules of the Torah. So it doesn't really fit anywhere. They're sort of neither fish nor fowl nor anything else. So they were, of course, nervous about that situation. What they wanted more than anything else was rock-solid guarantees of their internal self-government, the right to do it their way without outside interference, rock-solid guarantees of cultural and religious autonomy. They can maintain the culture and religion of their choice, and especially the religion, because they were primarily concerned about seeing that swallowed up. Well, what approaches could they use? Well, there was one group, we'll call it group number three, which if that doesn't make sense, we'll later, which was headed by the high priest, who in this period was not the one that jumped the gun and had the false start under Antiochus. This was his son. And please do not get these people confused, as is common in the class. This is a man with the same first name, but a different Roman numeral. This is Onias III, the son of the man who was in charge when they first came under the rule of Antiochus the Great. The high priest Onias III was the head of this party. The supporters of this, of the view expressed by Onias, was the bulk of the population. I'm using that rather than my rather pejorative term, the common herd, but it's the same group. However, on the other side, you had two other groups, which I'm going to put a line separating them, but I'm also going to put a, what do you call it? Not a bracket. What do you call this? What is the technical term for that? It's not a bracket. Right? Right. Ever heard it? Maybe it's a Canadianism. I'm suspicious, you see, when I consider where the source is. I don't know. Let's face it, Canada and the United States are not identical in culture, and there are differences of usage, and we tend to forget that sometimes. Canadians manage to blend in so well that except for their out and abouts, that you don't know who they are. Okay. The reason for this is they both shared a common approach, at least publicly. Secretly, they had differences of opinion. I don't mean that this group kept secrets from this group, but this group really kept secrets from that group. Now, we'll get into this now. It sounds very mysterious, I know. The head of group number one was a man whose name was Joshua, and he was the brother of the high priest. The head of this second group was a man by the name of Menelaus, and he lived up to the last part of his name, as you will find out quite readily. Even the choice of name tells you something about the man. But it doesn't. Okay, you're not aware of it yet. Okay. The supporters of both of these men were essentially the same group. It was your upper class landowners, landowning aristocracy, and your upper echelon, if I can use that word, priests. What do I mean by upper echelon priests? Because in those days, they didn't have different ranks in the priesthood, such as we have in the ministry today in the Church of God. But what I mean by upper echelon priests are not those that lived on their own landholdings in the countryside, like the bulk of the priests, and came up to Jerusalem only when it was the turn of their course to officiate at the temple. For example, you have in the New Testament the case of Zacharias as being that kind of a priest who lived elsewhere, you see, and only came to Jerusalem when it was time for his course to serve. And the fact the timing of the conception of his wife related to the time when he was serving in the temple. That's one way we can date the conception of John the Baptist, because the name of his course is given, and I think there are some records that indicate what part of the year that course served in Josephus, and therefore we can figure out what time of the year it was, and therefore count forward and find the time of the birth of John the Baptist. That was the bulk of the priests lived in that fashion. They lived on their own landholdings for most of the year and only came to Jerusalem when their course was serving. The upper echelon priests, however, were into the administrative organizational headquarters framework. And so they were always at Jerusalem and worked as sort of top-ranking administrators and advisors to the high priests. Now, these people, however, disagreed with the high priest in the approach that should be used as far as how they should secure these guarantees. Now, the high priest, going back to group number three for a minute, the high priest, Onias III, I'm going to draw a big wall between one and two on one side and three on the other side, because these one and two people basically outwardly shared the same objective, but the third group under the leadership of Onias III shared a totally different objective, so we'll make a nice solid separation. His policy that he would have liked to have followed would be to return to Ptolemaic rule. If the Ptolemaic ruler renewed Judea's status as temple land. But in other words, he favored secretly approaching the Ptolemaic ruler of Egypt and saying, look, because of the fortunes of war, we came under the rule of the Seleucids. We would be happier back under your rule, and we would be happy to cooperate with your armies if you sent them in to take over this area to secure your victory, providing if as a result you would grant us back our temple land status and therefore our traditional guarantees. Now, obviously this is a very risky course because it involves doing over again what they barely managed to pull off just maybe a short number of years before when they came under Seleucid rule. The exact timing would have to be involved so they didn't jump the gun prematurely. And they would have they'd be basically betting on a success of Ptolemaic military forces. If the military forces of the Ptolemies lost, then they'd really be in trouble. Everything would go down the tubes. Now, this view was not very popular by those who were educated, knowledgeable people, for the simple reason that the likelihood of the Ptolemies winning militarily over the Seleucid forces was very small. The Ptolemaic kingdom, I mentioned last time, in the period, you know, the last period of their rule over Judea, had been growing steadily weaker, largely because of a lack of effective leadership. Now, somebody asked me after one of the other classes, well, why didn't they have effective leadership? Well, partly I think it's because of heredity. Remember, they ruled as pharaoh. And traditionally in the Egyptian kingdom, the pharaoh married his sister or his half-sister, because the throne was not inherited father to son, the throne was inherited father to daughter. And whoever married the throne princess became the next pharaoh. Now, usually, of course, it was one of his own sons. So this brother-sister marriage, in many cases involving full brothers and sisters, and sometimes half-sisters, did, of course, work its result in that this weaker genes tended to come out, and it did affect the stability of the line, though it did eventually produce one gem at the very end, who was neither weak mentally or in any other way. I'm referring, of course, to Cleopatra, who was the last Ptolemaic ruler of Egypt. But besides that, you know, this was something that was a problem in his family. But besides that, it sometimes happens in monarchies that you get a succession of either incompetence or otherwise incapable rulers. This happened, for example, in England. After the death of Elizabeth I, you had a succession of maybe not totally incompetent, but certainly inadequate rulers in James I, Charles I, and then later James II, his son. Charles II, who came in between, being not that much better, which caused a great revolution in the English politics to take place. Now, so I think it was a result partly of heredity and partly by, quote, chance, which I wonder about, since God does intervene in history at strategic times for his purposes. But the Ptolemaic rulers did lack leadership, and the empire was growing weaker. This was still the situation here in this period of time. Consequently, to realistically expect the Ptolemaic armies to prevail over the Seleucids was a pipe dream. And anybody with any knowledge of the world scene, the immediate world scene, knew that was a pipe dream. Onias clung to it because he absolutely abhorred the solution proposed by this other group. Now, the reason why I say this other group, because publicly groups 1 and 2 presented themselves as one group. But in the minds of Menelaus and those that supported him, they had a secret extra program that they didn't even reveal to their partners in this other group. Now, this is where we need to see what this public program was and what this private, secret, extra program was in the mind of Menelaus and his small core of supporters. Because the majority of the supporters, the upper-class landowning aristocracy and upper-echelon priests, supported the publicly announced program of this group. There was only a small, select number of these supporters that were in with Menelaus in an additional secret, what would you say, addendum to this public program. Okay, what other alternative could they have devised, given the setup in which they lived? We've already seen what Onias' program was. We have to have something other. Is there any other way, given the system of the Seleucids, that you can secure guarantees from the state for internal self-government, as you choose, and for, you know, the religious autonomy? And this may seem rather paradoxical, but that's where it is. Daniel. Exactly. Develop Jerusalem as a Hellenistic polis. Now, why does that seem paradoxical? Yes?
Because if they do that, how would they keep their own culture?
Yeah, it seems like adopt the culture of the Hellenes so that you don't have to adopt the culture of the Hellenes and you can keep your own. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Well, the reason why it made sense was they intended to develop Jerusalem as a Hellenistic polis because that gave them a charter guaranteeing their rights to internal self-government by whatever code of laws they wished and the ability to practice their religion and devotion of whatever patron god they chose. But what they wanted to do was to create only a facade of Hellenization. They didn't really want to become Hellenized, but they recognized that they would have to put on a facade of Hellenization to look reasonably convincing that they were indeed a Hellenistic polis. They just wanted to adopt enough, quote, harmless features of Hellenistic society to give the outward appearance of being Hellenized that would win them a charter for Jerusalem, which would then guarantee their right to live by whatever laws they chose to establish. And what laws would those be? Greek-style laws? No. What laws would they be? The laws of the Torah would be the laws of the state, of the polis, you see. They would be allowed to choose and practice the worship of their patron god. Now, most polises chose Zeus. Some chose Apollo, but Zeus was the most popular choice. Who would they choose? Yahweh, you see. But you see, they'd have a guarantee that nothing could interfere with the worship of their chosen deity, you see, their patron god. They'd have a guarantee that nothing could interfere with their the laws by which they chose to work and live under. They just needed to borrow some of the harmless outer trappings of Hellenistic life. Put up some buildings in the Hellenistic architectural style. Adopt Greek forms of dress. Begin to use the Greek language instead of Aramaic. Already they weren't speaking, quote, the language of the Bible, Hebrew. So what would be wrong with switching and speaking the language of Greeks? You see, you know, makes no effective change. It just adds to the appearance of becoming Hellenized. Of course, they would have to begin the athletics. They couldn't see any harm in that per se. Even if they were to be run in the nude, which was typical among the Greeks, because that's just the way the Greeks did things. But they certainly planned to still practice circumcision, even though that would prevent their athletes from ever competing outside of Judea. They still planned to do that. And of course they'd study the Greek classics, because it would seem, what harm could there be in that, studying the Greek literature? Maybe stage a few Greek plays every year. In other words, they would put on this outer facade of Greek ways of living. And they said, after all, a lot of the Jews are living in Alexandria, which is a Hellenized city. Others are living throughout the Seleucid Empire, many of them in Hellenized cities, and they speak Greek, and they dress in the Greek way, and they live in Greek-style houses. So, and they're still Jews, so where's the harm? Where could the danger be? Well, the danger lurked in the mind of Menelaus and a few of his supporters. Because while giving a great deal of support to this public program, they had their own secret agenda, which was, once this had been achieved, to seize the leadership of this group and go all the way, to totally abandon Judaism. The secret program, as I said, which they had tightly held and kept secret from their public partners, was to totally abandon Judaism and the Jewish law, as they looked upon it. They didn't call it God's law, the Jewish law. They said, look, where are the promises of the prophets? What profit has it been to have kept our uniqueness and done all these things which have separated us from everybody else? Let's just accept the fact that those were all pipe dreams of slightly off-balance people, and nothing is ever going to come to pass. And let's just get with the wave of the future, which is Hellenism. Let's just give up and become one of more ingredient in this great Hellenistic stew. Let's blend in and stop trying to be different. Now, of course, very few people, you know, well, no one outside their own little group knew that this is what they secretly hoped to do. Everybody felt they were just part of this coalition that was interested in a facade of Hellenization. Okay, in order to understand what happened as a result of this, you might say, political split in Judea, which, as you can see, it's not just a political split, it's also a split that goes fairly closely on socioeconomic grounds, too. The lower classes siding with this rather unrealistic policy, the upper classes siding with this one. In order to understand what happened as they tried to implement this program, we need to understand what was going on in the larger Seleucid Empire. In 190 BC, Antiochus the Great suffered a significant military defeat. Antiochus the Great suffered a significant military defeat in 190 BC at the hands of the Romans. I believe the name of the battle was the Battle of Magnesia. The penalties imposed by the Romans involved the following. The rich commercial cities, Greek cities, of Asia Minor were removed from the Seleucid Empire. They weren't absorbed by Rome, but they were left independent. The rich commercial Greek cities of Asia Minor, cities like Sardis, Ephesus, for example, to mention two that you would be familiar with, were removed from the Seleucid Empire. This was a deliberate tactic of the Romans to weaken Antiochus's empire financially. In addition, the Seleucid Empire had to pay a heavy annual indemnity to Rome. So while they lost a great deal of their wealth-generating capacity, they were still saddled with a great burden of financial, annual financial burden they had to pay to the Romans each year. I think you know what an indemnity is, if not for any other reason but in connection with World War I. When Germany was expected to pay war reparations, you know, to the Allied powers. This is what basically this indemnity was, war reparations. Third, the expected heir of Antiochus, in other words, his oldest son, whose name was also Antiochus, this is the one we know of in history as Antiochus Epiphanes later, this individual had to go and live as a hostage in Rome. Now, once again, I need to explain, well, it happened in this class, I'm sorry, but I need to explain why the Romans took hostages, especially such high-ranking hostages, either princes of the ruling house or from the noble families. It wasn't just so they could threaten to kill them if their fathers revolted against the Romans. That wasn't the primary thing. The Romans almost never did that. They never took revenge in that fashion. They had a much bigger purpose in mind and taking the hostages. Because they took these hostages to Rome, but they didn't throw them in some dungeon. What they did is they put them up at no expense to them in the home of some wealthy and influential Roman family and introduced them around so that they were educated with the cream of Roman society, Roman youth, and they socialized and carried on all their other leisure time activities with the cream of Roman society. I might say, well, that's a strange thing to do with a hostage. What purpose do you have in that? Well, they had two purposes. One was to cause them to willingly identify with Rome and Roman policy because their friends, their associates would all be top, you know, level Romans. They hoped that they would be, in essence, as a result of this education with these top-level Romans and their socializing with them, that they would begin to identify with these people as being, well, we're really the same. Why should I oppose your policies? You know, we are friends. We have spent so many good times together, so many other pleasant experiences, and I've been educated to think like you. I mean, you know, this would be more natural to be supportive of Roman policy. In addition to this, you might say, weaning them to identify with Roman culture and Roman policies, there was also an attempt made to impress them by just showing them, you know, publicly, not hiding anything, how powerful and, quote, invincible Rome was. In other words, you talking about this young man Antiochus, someday you're going to go back home and rule the Seleucid Empire. You will go back home, we hope, with fond memories of your Roman friends, identifying with Roman political and diplomatic aims, and impressed with the invincibility of Rome. Because that way it wouldn't occur to you to want to fight us again. Because you know you just lose. Because we've shown you that we are just unbeatable. You know, we've taken you in behind the scenes and shown you that you just can't win against Rome. So this was their policy. Okay, eventually, and I'm skipping over some other events because it just clutters the landscape, Antiochus did go home and become king, ruler of the Seleucid Empire. Unfortunately, he didn't learn exactly the lessons that the Romans had hoped he would learn. He did appreciate Roman power. He had learned to appreciate how powerful the Romans were. That he had. But he had learned something that they had not intended he learned. And that was that Rome intended, when it was convenient for them, to fully conquer the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire and everything else in the East. It's just that they didn't want to do it until it was convenient. In the meanwhile, they would let them stay independent. You see, he gleaned a deeper understanding of their policy than they had intended for him to glean. That they were ultimately all intended to become subservient to the Romans. And so this inspired him to develop a policy that would first unify his own empire tightly, make it into a tightly organized, highly unified empire, and therefore stronger, and then forcibly, if necessary, annex the Ptolemaic Empire, therefore being able to tap its enormous wealth, as well as its military resources, and then using the combined financial and military resources of both of those empires, make war on Rome. Now, what was the key to starting this whole plan? The key to starting this whole plan was to increase the unity of his own empire. And the only way he could cement that empire more effectively together would be to break what had been the previous policy of encouraging Hellenization, but not pushing it where it wasn't wanted. In other words, they had used the carrot approach. The charters guaranteeing various exemptions and privileges and rights to entice local peoples to Hellenize. Now they would continue to use the carrot to a degree, but they would use the stick as well. Those peoples that were recalcitrant, they would force to Hellenize, because that was the only way they could achieve a high degree of unity among such a largely diverse population covering such a large area. And it is just at this time when Antiochus Epiphanes begins to launch into this more aggressive Hellenization policy that Joshua sees his opportunity to get what he wants. And what he does, in essence, is this. He goes to Antiochus Epiphanes, and first of all, he says, I hate to say this, but my loyalty to you as my sovereign makes me. My brother, the high priest, is a traitor. He is plotting to turn Judea over to the Ptolemaic Empire. That's item number one on the agenda. Item number two is I represent the really influential people in Judea. And as a token of their loyalty and of their desire to see your objective of increasing the Hellenization of your empire, that we sympathize with these aims, we are presenting you with this large monetary gift, which was a fairly substantial sum of money, a thinly disguised bribe, and ask that in order that I may carry out this policy, which is important to us and so dear to your own heart, of seeing more Hellenization in your realm, I ask you to appoint me as high priest in place of my traitorous brother. And I faithfully guarantee that we will Hellenize Jerusalem. Well, Antiochus was very pleased with this. First of all, he needed money. One, to pay the annual war reparation bill to Rome. That would come in handy. He also needed money to increase his military forces. And he liked the idea that the most notable resistant group to Hellenization was now had a leadership that said that they wanted to Hellenize. And so he ordered Onias III to appear before him in his capital, put him into prison, deposed him as high priest, and made his brother Joshua the new high priest. And Joshua promptly took the name Jason to show where his cultural and political allegiances were. And the facade of Hellenization was applied to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was organized as a polis. Now, what I mean by that is not the entire city became a polis. Don't get the wrong impression. But a polis was organized at Jerusalem. In other words, you had two civic corporations coexisting in the same city. Everyone who was a Jerusalemite was a citizen of Jerusalem. But selected Jerusalemites were also citizens of a new civic organization, which was the polis at Jerusalem, which was given the name, wisely chosen, to impress the king, Antioch at Jerusalem. So a separate civic identity was created in Jerusalem called Antioch at Jerusalem, and upper echelon aristocrats and upper echelon priests were invited to become citizens of this new polis, and they put in the Greek educational system, they put in the system of Greek athletics, they began to learn and speak Greek, dress as Greeks, put up homes in the Greek architectural style. And of course, as citizens of the polis, they received the red carpet treatment wherever they traveled in this Seleucid Empire, no longer treated as minor figures, but as major visiting dignitaries. They also received partial tax exemptions. They also received the economic trading privileges that were typical for citizens of the polis. But most of all, they received a charter guaranteeing their internal self-government, and of course the rights of their patron god, who was to be Yahweh. So it looks like they accomplished their objective with very little damage, except what? Why was this such a dangerous thing in this particular setting? Why were they, what had, you know, dangerous things had they introduced even? Yes. Yes, it began to rub off on the others as well. Never having had a chance to go and see it, functioning in its natural home, they had never come to appreciate it. Now, having it brought to them, many of them began to look at it and say, well, that's not so bad. What have I been afraid of all these years? You know, they began to become more sympathetically inclined to this. What else was dangerous? Yes?
Well, it sets up a backlash for those Moniacs' supporters, you know. When they see all this happen, they get even more zealous.
Right. So the real supporters of the old way became even more extreme. They moved two notches further to the right, you might say. They're not yet at the other end, but they've moved two notches further to the right and begun to create a seriously disturbed minority. Not yet ready to take action, but they're seriously disturbed. What else has happened? Yes, John? You see, what he could also do later, you see. And of course, he wants to go all the way with this, not just a facade. The door has been opened, you see, to further change, which is exactly what's going to take place in the next act. And what else has happened? They've created in the mind of the king the impression that they voluntarily want to do this and that the bulk of the population wants it too. They created that thought in Antiochus's mind that the bulk of the population wants to adopt Hellenism, that we freely want to do this, which the importance of that we'll see later. What else has happened is the legitimacy of the inheritance of the high priest's office has been tampered with. This used to be an independent institution, the holder holding it by right of descent without interference from the king. Now, the king has interfered in who is the high priest and gotten away with it. That opens the door for him to interfere again, you see. You're tampering with the institution of the high priesthood. And it's up to now inviolate inheritance pattern, you see. Now, we're going to see how these things get worse next time when we take over the next step under the Seleucid persecution. when Menelaus makes his bid for power. Okay.